We've all been following the fast-moving events coming out of Washington the past few days, but there is other news that you should know about. Welcome. Thanks for being a part of the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. And since it is Friday, in case you missed it, there was a lot going on around here this past week, and we're going to get to a bunch of the stories in just a moment. But I don't want to forget to tell you that later on, I'm going to read some of the emails and comments that you were nice enough to send in over the last week or so. That'll be coming up later in the program. But I'm going to start with a story that we've been following for some time now. The New York Islanders are going to be moving in a few years to a new arena in Belmont Park, if the lawsuits to stop the move are unsuccessful. Jim Bomback is an investigative enterprise sports reporter for Newsday, and Candace Ferretti covers Nassau County government and politics on Long Island for Newsday. Welcome both. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having
us. Hi, thank you.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Candace. Jim, give us a little bit of history. Where's the new development and arena to be located, and why is it going there?
So a little bit of history is a lot of history with the Islanders. I mean, they've been after an arena for quite some time. They've basically been looking for a new home or a modernized home for three decades, since the mid-'80s. Basically, Nassau Coliseum, their old arena, was seemed to be outdated the second that they opened the door, it seemed like, from their perspective. And where they're looking right now is essentially on what a parking lot was at Belmont Park. Belmont Park is on the Nassau-Queens border, technically Nassau, so Long Island grabs the rights to it, but it's essentially this 43 acres of parking lots, and that's where they figured that is the best spot to build an arena, and especially because it's state land.
I was just going to say, Candace, these 43 acres, all owned by New York State, right off the Cross Island Parkway, and some people I know have been saying, you can't do this with the state land because that's what it wasn't designed for.
Sure. Thank you. Yes, there are opposition groups, certainly in the surrounding communities, who have filed. There are two lawsuits that have been filed against the project, decrying the process, the state approval process. Both of those lawsuits, the governor has deemed non-credible in a story that we had this week. And, you know, I guess the courts will just decide, but it is state land, and it did go through the Empire State Development Corporation's seeker process. So, you know, we'll just have to see what kind of impact these lawsuits will have.
Candace, as you mentioned, Governor Cuomo was there the other day, and it was for a ceremonial groundbreaking. And here's a bit of what he had to say.
It is exactly what Long Island deserved. The Islanders were just more than a hockey team. They were a Long Island identity.
And Governor Cuomo, Candace, just to be sure about this, he identifies himself as a Queens boy, I believe he called himself?
Yes, yes. He actually grew up along the Grand Central Parkway. As a Queens girl myself, I'm well aware of his roots. And as a matter of fact, he, John Ledecky, who is the owner of the Islanders and the NHL commissioner, happen to all be from Queens. So that they were sort of making a joke about it at the ceremonial groundbreaking. But at the end of the day, yeah, it's been an underused piece of property, the largest state-owned piece of property. So if Governor Cuomo did want to keep the Islanders on Long Island and maybe even in New York, this was probably the place that made the best sense for him.
Jim, I'm going to ask you to comment on the lawsuits in just a moment. But before we do that, I want to play a little clip from Aubrey Phillips. Aubrey is a spokesman for the Belmont Park Community Coalition.
The governor knows that our community has rejected stadiums in the past. There was a soccer stadium before. The governor also knows that what we want in our community is what we call sustainable economic development.
Jim, tell us a little bit more about the lawsuits. Where does it stand now in the court proceedings? And from your perspective, from what you've been hearing, do they have a chance at succeeding?
early stages. I mean, they've just been filed, and it's going to take some time. I mean, the Floral Park one was filed first, probably a good week and a half before the Elmont Civic one. It's not going to be heard by the court for a good 6 weeks at this point till the end of October. Do they stand a chance? Number one, only a judge can say that. Number two, there is a very low bar in what the state needs to meet to show. They basically need to show they acted in a rational manner. So essentially, they just need to show that they were not corrupt. Now, the people behind the lawsuits might argue otherwise, but arguing that and proving it is two different things. I mean, one thing that Aubrey says in that clip is that they've rejected the soccer stadium, and that's a reference to a previous RFP in which there was a soccer stadium that was pitched at this spot. That RFP never was decided, and the community was split. I mean, so the Aubrey's group was against it, but it doesn't mean that everybody was against it, and that's the tough part with a project like this. And that's one thing that Cuomo mentioned the other day, is that with a large project, you're going to have supporters, you're going to have detractors. And Floral Park, on the northwest side of Belmont Park, they filed a lawsuit because they are concerned what it's going to mean for them, because the north lot, the parking lot on the north side of Belmont, is now going to be used for parking, and that they're worried about what that means for those residents. The civic leaders of Elmont, they're concerned about this, but they were always against it from day one. That doesn't automatically mean, though, that all of Elmont is against it. The Islanders project, when they went for approval at ESD, the major approval over the summer, everyone who showed up there was essentially Elmont supporters of it. So it's hard to know. You can't say one way or the other if Elmont is for or against, because there's people on split sides. That's not surprising. And in terms of what it means for a lawsuit, I mean, there's a heavy bar for those groups to meet in this process.
Candace, driving on the Cross Island, and I know it well, like driving on other roads around here, it can be quite the headache at times. What's being planned in terms of public transportation?
Well, that's a great point. Yes, the Cross Island is jammed. I'm on it nearly every day. But this project is unique in that the developers are investing private money to build Long Island's first new full-time commuter rail stop at Elmont, that they anticipate will service the stadium. I don't know how many people are going to take it, and how many cars there was an estimate that was thrown out there by ESD, but there's no real way of knowing how that's going to alleviate the vehicular traffic on the Cross Island. But that's a huge, that's a big piece of this project, is a new Long Island's first new railroad stop in 50 years. I mean, so great. There's a great amount of effort and attention, I think, to vehicular traffic, if that's one of the components that probably drove it over the finish line. To be quite frank,
Jim, how many jobs? We have about 2 minutes left in our segment. How many jobs are we talking about for the construction? I mean, how many jobs will also be there when everything is finally built?
Yeah, obviously there are estimates at this point, but they're saying 10,000 construction jobs. I think it was something in the vicinity of 3,000 jobs with the project after the fact. I mean, that's a big factor for the community. There was some number also mentioned that they committed to doing something like 30% of the jobs will be given to some within a 5-mile radius. So basically, it's going to be local people working there, or at least giving them the first right of refusal in many cases. With a project like this, and it's something they need to do to gain the support of the neighbors that it's going to affect more so than anyone else.
Candace, can you give us a timeline? When is everything, let's say the lawsuits fail and everything keeps going forward, when do they expect everything to be open?
Jim is probably a better person to ask that question of. I think next season, right, Jim?
So October 2021, which sounds far away because of that 20 aspect of it, but it's really only, I guess it's 2 years from next month.
And we've been talking a lot about the arena, but there's so much more to this. There's a hotel there, right? There are retail stores. It's a huge complex.
Yeah.
Yeah, 350,000 square feet of retail. Lots of it's going to be outdoor. It's all going to be outdoor retail. It's essentially going to be a walking outdoor mall, futuristic if you ask them, with a 250-room hotel. It's essentially, upgrading. You know, it's dropping in a brand new glossy outdoor mall, outdoor hotel, and even the Long Island Railroad looks glossy in the renderings.
So, Canis, just to clarify where we are right now, as of right now, construction is proceeding while the lawsuits move forward?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jim and I were out there on Monday. There's certainly a lot of overturned dirt and big construction equipment. They are actively working on it. So it's no small feat, given, you know, exactly what Jim said. You know, it's been decades long for the Islanders to find this. And, you know, I just want to note that the $2.7 billion in economic impact, that's a number that's been floated out there. So for Nassau County, for the region, I think that the size of this project is not insignificant.
Candace Ferretti covers Nassau County government and politics on the island for Newsday, and Jim Bomback is an investigative enterprise sports reporter for Newsday. Candace, Jim, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
If you want to comment on today's program, email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. On Facebook, find us at Full Story WSHU. And please remember that all our shows are available as podcasts. Download the Full Story on Google Play or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. One short break. We'll be right back. It's the weekly news roundup on The Full Story. I'm Ron Ropiak. If you want to comment on today's program, email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. And you can find us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. We're going to continue with our discussion now. We're going to switch it up a little bit in terms of politics. We were just talking about development over in Belmont, but we're going to bring in WSHU's chief political reporter, Ebong Udama, who's in the studio with me, right to my right, and across the table from me is Ken Dixon, who writes for Hearst Connecticut Media. And on the phone is Sue Haig, and Sue covers the state capital of Hartford for the Associated Press. Welcome all, and hi, Sue. How are you?
Good, Ron. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Hey, Sue, New York Governor Cuomo and Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont had another get-together recently. What's going on with this? Is it too soon to use the word bromance? I mean, what are they working on?
Well, I think both governors have been reaching out to their colleagues. I know Governor Lamont had a get-together here in Connecticut before with the governors of Massachusetts and Rhode Island. But this time around, the meeting with Cuomo focused on, you know, a bunch of different things, but primarily vaping issue and recreational marijuana. And the two governors have this thought that if they were to take any action on vaping, or if they want to legalize recreational use of marijuana, the two states should probably work together, because people are definitely going to probably cross the border into the other state to get these products if the laws are different in their home state. So what they did was they proposed to have a summit on October 17th. And at first it sounded like it was just going to be about legalizing marijuana, but it sounds like they're also going to talk about vaping. But they want to try to come up with some of the same guidelines and standards for marijuana, and make sure that, and propose respective legislation in both of their states at some point, probably next year.
Ebong, my friend, it's always good to see you. What's your take on this?
It's good to see you too, Ron. I would say it's best to listen to how they described it themselves. It seems as if the fact that we have what's going on in Washington now is making them turn to each other. And this is how Governor Cuomo explained it.
The undeniable bottom line is you're getting very little assistance from the federal government. So you are on your own. And to the extent states can work together, we need to work together. We need the thinking, We need the collective action, because none of us have been here before. I don't think this country has ever been in this position before.
And here is how Lamont explained why they got together.
The states are stepping in and filling a void left by the federal government. And that's why we're taking the lead on a lot of these different issues. I think more importantly, I am proud that Connecticut is part of the greater, New York City ecosystem. New York City is the global capital of the world, and we're a part of that. And the more we work together, be it transportation, these other things, the better it is for Connecticut, and I think the better it is for our region, including New York.
So that's the take from the governors.
Ken, you and I had touched on this a few weeks back, but we were talking about it more in terms of a number of the lawsuits that were being filed nowadays by attorneys general from New York, from Connecticut, Massachusetts, so on. And we were talking about that it seems to be being done on a regional basis to go after the federal government. This, in turn, seems to be the governor saying, let's work together economically.
Yeah, I think you almost need a scorebook to figure out how many cases Attorney General Tong is involved. These guys, Massachusetts is eating their lunch on recreational marijuana. I find taking the lead, that quote from the governor, kind of amusing. Vaping is a fast-breaking story. I don't think anybody can depend on the FDA to do anything, Food and Drug Administration to do anything. Gave him a reason to get together. Ned didn't go for the visual of taking him to some crazy fishing hole or anything. So
I thought they would at least have gone for some good New Haven pizza.
He did give him a fishing license.
Oh, yeah, I missed that part. Well, there you go. It's all about the optics then, isn't it, Ebon? Yeah.
Sue, I know we're talking about marijuana. I know we're talking about vaping. Are any other issues, do you think, or areas that they want to cooperate on going to come out in the next few days?
Oh, I don't think in the next few days, but, they've talked about different things, about how the two states can possibly work together on, dealing with an emergency, having better cooperation between the two states and storms and things like that. They've talked about maybe they can work together on transportation. They did say they did not speak about tolls, although it did come up when Lamont had his meeting prior with the governors of Massachusetts and Rhode Island. But it seemed like the bigger news coming out of this one more was about vaping and about marijuana.
It's ironic because last session, both in New York and Connecticut, they pushed for marijuana and it stalled. Mm. And I don't know how they're going to retool it to make it work next year, but it seems that's what this is all about.
In an election year, yeah, dream on. Maybe they've been going up to Massachusetts themselves, but that's not an issue to run a campaign in an election year.
So Sue, go ahead.
I was going to say Governor Cuomo was talking about that, because there's a possibility, too, New Jersey could be brought into this as well. But he was saying how maybe these states can kind of focus on some of the core issues, because in Connecticut, the marijuana issue kind of got a little bit bogged down with this whole issue of whether or not past drug offenses, drug convictions should be erased. And Governor Cuomo was talking about maybe if we just focus on some of these core issues together, then maybe the states can get something passed.
I don't want to spend a ton of time on it today because we've talked about it so often in the past, but you mentioned tolls, and we had talked a number of weeks ago that there were possibly going to be a special session in August, in September, in October, and one of the issues to be tackled was whether or not tolls would be going on the roads in Connecticut. I haven't seen or read or heard anything about a special session nowadays, anything to do with tolls. So I have to ask, is this issue dead? And as Ken said, if it dies this year, considering next year is an election year, Is it done for then for at least through the end of 2020? Abog, I'm going to throw this one to you.
Well, that's why they seem to want to do it in a special session and not wait until next year to deal with it. They say they've come up with, they're working on something that would reduce the number of tolls, maybe just toll a few bridges or something like that. But I don't know. We'll see if they'll have a special session on transportation this fall. All sides seem to want to do it in the fall or not at all.
Oh, nice rhyme. Thanks, Omar.
So what do you think, Mr. Dixon?
You know, I'm looking at my watch. It's like, oh, it's end of September. It's like, yeah, no, it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen this year? And then if it doesn't happen this year, it doesn't happen next year?
Well, election year, anything controversial is tough. I mean, they are going to get together and sooner or later and do something about this hospital tax and lawsuit that's been hanging fire for like a year now. But that's the only thing they really, really have to do.
Sue Haig?
The issue of transportation is definitely not dead, though. The governor is supposed to come out with a revised transportation plan that would probably focus on the next 10 years. And the other day, the lawmakers met with some representatives from the federal government to look at some low-cost borrowing options that they might be able to do. And there is a possibility that to pay off that borrowing, there might be limited tolls in the Governor Lamont's revised plan. So the issue is still out there. The Lamont administration still feels that it's very important that Connecticut get the ball rolling on some of these major transportation initiatives that need to get fixed, these major transportation problems that need to get fixed.
Let's touch on the what's going on in the Park City, in Bridgeport, which is Connecticut's largest city.
Still
the largest city, which I think sometimes gets overlooked.
On primary days.
On primary days. Yeah. Not when it comes to politics. So for those who don't know, Bridgeport recently had a primary, a Democratic mayoral primary. And Joe Ganim, who is the incumbent mayor, was the victor in that primary. And Abog, I'm going to ask you to pick it up from there. What is the controversy now with that vote?
Well, he won eventually after the absentee ballots were counted because he lost on the votes that were cast on Election Day. And it was when the absentee ballots came in that he won by, I think he got in about 900 absentee ballots and was able to overwhelm Mary Moran.
That goes back to the 1980s.
We're not going to hold that against you. I don't know if 290 votes is overwhelming anything. You know, it might be as many people hanging around an island or practice or something.
So State Senator Marilyn Moore basically is saying a lot of these absentee ballots were not valid, and she's asking the state to do what, Ken?
Well, the State Elections Enforcement Commission has started an investigation. The city's turned over a bunch of records on the absentee ballots. She was relying on the Hearst Connecticut Media's reports in her complaint that was sent to the Secretary of the State, who referred that to the State Elections Enforcement Commission this week.
And you guys, I have to say, you did a fantastic job with that. Congratulations. Sue, what takes place now on the state level when it comes to this?
Well, as Ken said, the State Elections Enforcement Commission is now going to investigated. They issued subpoenas this week, trying to get the ballots, get all these different records.
You know, what you have to look at here is that the investigation is probably not going to be over before the November election.
Mm. November election? How about before the new arena is built in Belmont?
But anyway, I figure that right now Joe Ganim is focused on trying to rally as much support as he can get before November, because that was a real wake-up call for him. Moore did not have a very dynamic campaign, and yet she was able to beat him at the polls on Election Day. And that means that the vote must have been anti-Ghanem votes. That was what probably drove the voters out. Because and that is something that Mayor Ghanem will have to work on, because these are the party insiders that show up on primary day. These are the people who are actively involved. If he's losing out with those folks, what about the larger electorate?
Well, she's done it on a shoestring, with hardly any money, with hardly any staff, and she beat him on the machines. And he beat her 3-1 on absentees. She's made some major miscues. She didn't get enough signatures. She only needed 207 signatures to get her own independent line for Election Day, and she was able to get 2,500 signatures to force the primary. It was like, so she's going to ask people to, like, get on Election Day, look down the ballot, fill in the little bubble that says write in candidate, and then write in her name. And she's going to need 400 people at the polls on Election Day.
So just to clarify, she will be on the ballot on Election Day.
Yes, but no. Because it's a write-in. So there's, like, space at the bottom. You can fill in the little bubble that says write-in candidate, and then you can write in her name there. But those are three things that people are going to have to look at. She's depending on this new lawsuit from this group, Bridgeport Generation Now, is behind. They interviewed 50 people. They better interview another 50 more before the court case on Tuesday, because they don't have a line of people saying these Ghanem operatives were filling out the absentee ballot for me, and that's the illegal, that's the felony right there.
Mm.
And but no judge is going to. It's unlikely that a judge is going to overturn.
Do they have any witnesses that are going to be showing up in court on Tuesday?
Well, that's a good question. I expect so, but this is all preliminary hearing stuff, but their filing so far is not very thick. It's too bad, because she had an opportunity, and if she wins, it's going to be the hardest way possible.
Sue Haig, just with the 2 minutes that we have left in the before we take our break, can you tell us a little bit about what is going on in New Haven with Mayor Tony Harp?
I'm not the right person to ask about that. I'm sorry.
I think she's going to spend more time with her family, right?
But basically, she's still on the ballot for November, because she lost in the primary, the Democratic primary, but she was also on the Working Families Party line. She had the endorsement of the Working Family Party. So she's going to be on their line in November. However, she's suspended her campaign. She's not going to campaign anymore. And for her to lose that badly in the Democratic primary, I think she feels that it's up. It's not worth it.
That was like the first election she lost, and she's had a distinguished career. A heavy hitter up in Hartford. She's 72, and it could be time to think of another phase of life.
Has she given any indication of what she's thinking about doing next? Because and anyone who knows the mayor knows that she's very active, very energized, and I somehow just can't see her going to the sidelines.
Yeah, I'm not sure. She spoke at the late Charles Tisdale's memorial service recently, like just a couple of weeks before the primary, and she was articulate and emotional and obviously in mourning for an old close friend. And I'm really glad I got to see her at that moment.
Sue Haig from the AP is with us. She covers Hartford. Mr. Ken Dixon, a member of the Journalism Hall of Fame in Connecticut, writes for Hearst Connecticut Media, and Abang Udama, who is WSHU's chief political correspondent. Now, speaking of politics, there is something going on in Washington over the last week or two, and I would love to get your perspective and your thoughts on it. About, I'm guessing about a month and a half ago, 4th District Congressman Jim Himes was in here. And he, at that time, kind of shocked, I think, the political establishment, because he came out and he wouldn't say that he wanted impeachment at that time, but he was pushing for an impeachment inquiry. He was the first member of the delegation around here to do that, and it kind of shocked some members of the political establishment that Jim Himes was making this leap to do that. Now, Abang, everyone in Connecticut is basically rowing in the same direction, in the same boat?
Well, the entire delegation.
Okay.
And the last person to come on board was Rosa DeLauro, and she did that the night before Speaker Pelosi came out and made her announcement that they were starting an impeachment inquiry. And about a week and a half ago, Speaker Pelosi was in Connecticut, and I went to the event. She was there with Rosa DeLauro, the congresswoman from New Haven, and it was at Gateway Community College in New Haven, and I asked about impeachment, and both of them said they're sticking to the topic of the day, which was women's empowerment, and they were not going to talk about anything else. And it was very obvious that Speaker Pelosi was I'm not too sure if she knew this was coming down the pike, but she was not going to tip her hand in any way. And as soon as Rosa DeLauro made the announcement, because she's very close to Speaker Pelosi, made the announcement Monday night, it was pretty obvious that what was coming down. And right now, the entire delegation. But before that, on Monday, State Senator, not State Senator, U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, came out and had a press avail in Hartford in which he called for impeachment inquiry. And he is now playing a pretty significant role in all this, because he went to Ukraine and he met with the Ukrainian president, and he talked about it. He's been talking about it for the past week and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to see that the president pouncing on that meeting and calling Murphy out for that. And so it's now today, the senior U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal came out with his news conference this morning, in which he says, you know, that they're hoping that there'll be a trial, an investigation, mm-hmm. and impeachment in the House, and it will come to the Senate. He says they're already talking about that in the U.S. Senate. So we'll see how it goes.
A few weeks back, Pelosi was in Hartford for the big Democratic fundraiser, and she was kind of teasing everybody about the inevitability of some kind of action. I mean, this whole time that the mechanism has been pointing toward an impeachment inquiry, and I think maybe the latest revelations of the Ukrainian scandal, or maybe the final straw that got things going, although I think there's still some orders that Pelosi would have to give to actually get some committee action going on this.
Sue, what are you hearing from the Hartford perspective?
Well, both Blumenthal and Murphy were at the Capitol today, and you know, both of them had held back for a while in terms of telling the House what they thought they should do, and they said that they felt that and they had no choice after this whole incident regarding the Ukrainian president. One thing I think is kind of interesting is what does this mean for issues that Connecticut cares about? And one of those big issues is gun control. And both Murphy and Blumenthal today were saying, who are very active in that issue, like Blumenthal is very active in this whole red flag law, and Murphy is interested in the whole background check. They said they think they're still willing to negotiate with the White House, even though they're supporting this impeachment investigation. And Senator Blumenthal actually said, he got a call around the same time that Pelosi was going to call for this impeachment committee from the White House, saying they still want to move forward with it. So it sounds like they're hoping that maybe they can still get something done despite this whole thing going on in the background.
How realistic do you think that is?
I don't know. Because they have
been optimistic about gun control for years. Every time you talk with Blumenthal and Murphy, it's always, we're hopeful. Maybe this will be the time. And this is since Newtown, which was 2013. Right. That was the first push when they had President Obama in office. So, and quite frankly, looking at it, I don't see how President Trump is going to focus on anything else other than what has to do directly with impeachment.
So you read my mind, Abong. We had Senator Chris Murphy on the air with us recently. And a number of months ago, the last time he and I spoke, and we spoke about the gun reform legislation, and he was trying his best. He was somewhat optimistic, but at the same time, he understood his relationship with President Trump was somewhat precarious, if you will. But just recently, and as he told us during our discussion, he spent 40 minutes with the president where they went over the red flag legislation, the proposals, and other gun reform background checks and so on. And then he met with Attorney General Barr, and he felt, the senator, that he was making progress and he was willing to reach out to get things done. And as soon as this impeachment process started the other day, and I was watching the senator on MSNBC, and he came out on the Chris Matthews show, and he said, I'm going to take a few days to think about this. And the next day, he actually came out and said what he thought. But that evening, I'm thinking, all that work that he's put into gun reform legislation, has that just gone away because of this? So I don't know.
Well, the president's tactics are like deflect and defend and attack and then show everybody like some little shiny object over here while you're giving your climate away and putting the environment at risk. So, I'm not too optimistic personally. Mm. I don't cover Washington.
Murphy actually tweeted after he was attacked by Trump and said, look, that he's still holding out hope that he can continue dealing with that, even with this impeachment issue going on. But I don't know how that happens, knowing the history of President Trump.
So what are you hearing in the halls of the state capitol? What's the feeling that you get nowadays from both sides of the political aisle?
Not much. I mean, first of all, there aren't a lot of people here, I'll be honest. We see more of Murphy and Blumenthal than we do right now of the legislature.
Yeah, because on Fridays
that there hasn't been, we haven't heard comments from a lot of the state lawmakers after the Pelosi announcement. I mean, the state Democrats say they support it, and our entire congressional delegation supports it, but it's nothing, something that the legislators, I haven't seen much in terms of comment.
Do you think that they're waiting to see what the public sentiment is?
I don't know. I can't speculate.
Uh-huh. Ken, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, the Republicans don't have a whole lot of material they can use when you start asking them to comment on the president. So there's some deflection going on also. You know, Murphy and Blumenthal are pretty famous for Monday and Friday news conferences, either on their way to Washington or on their way back. Connecticut media is very limited down in Washington, and they're getting bang for their buck, you know, having news conferences up in the state capitol.
Uh-huh. Hey, Bog, you've been covering this for quite a number of years. You're WSHU's chief political reporter. When you go out and you talk to the politicians that you know, what's their take on the impeachment proceedings?
I haven't really talked to too many people after Nancy Pelosi came out. So it would be, I wouldn't be able to tell you what the thinking is. However, you know, with Democrats in the state, they are all for, I mean, all the elected ones I've spoken with are all for impeaching Trump. And I was at an event with Attorney General Tong and Robin Porter and a few other members of the state delegation from the New Haven area about a week ago, and there's no love lost on the administration in Washington, so I would think that they're all for impeachment right now, and I think the Republicans would just keep quiet.
You know, Sue, I kept you so much longer today than we anticipated. I appreciate your time, and thank you for always coming on and giving us your thoughts and your comments.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'll speak with you soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, Kenny?
Hey, Ron, you know, you didn't mention during the first segment about how Bridgeport is the location of the farm team of the Islanders hockey team, you know, the Sound Tigers.
I did not mention that, and
we've got a solid connection to Cross County Parkway.
And I should have, and I will.
Or Cross Island, sorry.
Well, no, now you know where the Cross Island Parkway is.
Yeah, yeah. Keep me away from it.
You do want to stay away from it. You never want to go on the Cross Island. Late at night, possibly it's okay, but during the daytime, it can be quite the headache.
Are you old enough to remember the Comac Arena? The original home of the New York Nets. Yeah.
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. And not only that, I remember when the Nets played in New Jersey. Yeah. And just a little piece of trivia. For years, I valued my red, white, and blue ABA ball from the New Jersey Nets with the Julius Irving logo on it. City kid, what do you want?
Yeah.
But anyway, I digress. Gents, thank you. I appreciate you coming in. As always, Ebong Udama and Ken Dixon. With the remaining time on our show today, I'd like to share some of the emails and the comments that we received recently. In response to our show on teaching emotional skills to all of us, but really concentrating on kids in schools, Geraldine wrote this. Your guests are describing the Catholic school environment. It involves teaching social skills, teaching behaviors, teaching kids to be self-confident and to move through the world with social skills. We're not exactly reinventing the wheel here. On the show where we interviewed Senator Chris Murphy that we were just talking about, and we spoke about the whistleblower and the Ukraine, we also had a guest on that program who is a PhD doctoral candidate in political science at UConn. Now, he's originally from Ukraine, and he indicated there were some in that country who had questions and concerns about Joe and Hunter Biden. Kathy wrote, as a regular listener to your show, I was deeply concerned with the Ukrainian guest on your show. Toward the end of the segment, he suggested that there had been wrongdoing which was covered up. You correctly pointed out that there had indeed been an investigation which cleared the Bidens of wrongdoing. I understand your desire to have opposing viewpoints represented, but I hope that in the future you'll ensure that your guests stick to the facts. Tom wrote, from what I've read, Biden's son Hunter is corrupt, and I'm a little surprised there are two standards for various people. I'd like to see objective journalists look at the accusations against Biden and influence peddling. From our show about climate change and what it's doing to plants and fish in our region, Stephanie wrote to us on Facebook, and she said, "Hi, as far as commercial fishing in the area, my husband and I have been in the business for 30 years. He fishes out of Matatuck Inlet. The fish migratory patterns are changing. For example, we're getting black sea bass in early May, where they used to show up in June because the water is warmer. This caused a problem because the fishermen were not able to legally land the bass until June. So they had to throw them all back, even though they were very plentiful. And finally, I'm going to go back about a week or two now because we weren't able to read emails last Friday. One of the shows that we did recently was about the lack of affordable housing in our region. John Engel wrote to us, and he said, "I'm the chairman of the town council in New Canaan. I'm also a realtor. I also have two children in their 20s who can't afford to move back to New Canaan. You asked for out-of-the-box thinking. We should make use of the existing housing stock instead of building new. We should have affordable housing in every neighborhood. We should give a tax break to the landlords who are already providing affordable housing. We have many, many homes that have illegal garage apartments. We should make them legal. We should make it not only legal, but a tax benefit to make those apartments available to our police, teachers, and firemen." That's it for the emails for this week. Thank you all for your emails and your comments. Please keep them coming. You could email us at tfs@wshu.org. And on Facebook, we're at Full Story WSHU. And please remember, you can download our show as podcasts. You can download the Full Story on Google Play or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberta Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Have a wonderful weekend, and thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.